serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to hear about something that was unfolding 75 years ago from one of the last men left to tell that story. Don Hardenbrook of Weezer, Idaho, served with SOCO, the secret Sino-American cooperative organization wreaking havoc behind enemy lines in the China-Burma-India theater in World War II. SOCO destroyed over 200 bridges, more than 140 ships, and more than 80 trains while suffering remarkably few casualties.
Towards the end of the war, we were sent down in Amoy to take out. We had to swim across from the mainland over to the island, and it was only about 3 miles. But we were to blow up their generator at their airstrip and also to drop a big water tank, which probably had 50,000 or 100,000 gallons. It was a big water tank, and it had four legs on it. And so we took out the armature of the big electrical equipment. And then we dropped 2 legs of the water. And then we ran down to the beach, and we were going to have to swim back. And with any boats or anything, we knew probably that we would not make it, because you don't swim 3 miles quickly with a uniform on and your sidearms and that sort of thing.
So are you saying this felt to you, that your assessment of the situation was that this was almost like a suicide mission?
No, it wasn't a suicide mission, because you knew you could swim over there. And I just always figured that something would happen so it wouldn't be so bad. So we started to run down to the beach. A couple of the Chinese, they said, Nikonikon, Nikonikon, look, CC. And we turned around and looked, and the Japanese were coming out of the building after we had dropped the water tower. And they were all staggering around, and we didn't do the Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of blow-up stuff. We just did a little pip and then dropped stuff. But anyway, we got over on the other side finally, swam over, and we had a crank-up generator, and we called back to headquarters. And the old man said, where are you? And I said, on the mainland. He said, well, did you do your job? And I said, yes, sir. He said, what did you do? And so we told him about the water tower and told him about the armature. And he said, well, you weren't supposed to do that. And I said, sir, you gave us explicit orders on what to do. Well, you shouldn't have done it. I don't know what I said. Maybe something like, why shouldn't we have done it? And he said, the war was over 2 days ago, and the Japanese were all celebrating, and they were having a big sake party, and they were just blew their mind because the war was over. And so he said, okay, we'll see you in Shanghai. And we said, well, that is a long way away. You know, it's 280 miles away or so from there, maybe further, 300. He said, well, you'll find a way, or you can walk. And it was at least 200 miles back to the base. We'd already walked that to come down and go on to do that, because we didn't have vehicles.
So what'd you guys do?
Well, we stole a Japanese ambulance, and it got us about 80 or 90, maybe 100 miles, and the rest of it we walked.
It ran out of gas?
Yeah, and we put oil in it. We put everything we could, but it didn't work very well, and tried to steal whatever we could, because that was our job, was to make do, you know, with whatever you could. And so finally, we got to Shanghai, and the old man, the captain, and the people who had come by rail, they came 2 days after we had walked all the way to Shanghai. They were there 2 days after we got there. So that was the end of the war, and Generalissimo Chang was there with his wife. They had a big dance, a big party, wonderful thing. And I got to dance with Madame Chang. She was a beautiful little lady, a wonderful Christian lady. And here was this string bean of a kid that got to dance with her. And I remembered it for the rest of my life, and she probably forgot it as quickly as she could.
That circumstance, I know you're a teenager, and maybe at that age things roll off you like water off a duck's back, but when you realize that here you feel like you're putting your life at risk, and you realize you have to swim back, if there are boats, they're going to catch you, you may die. I mean, that's what's going through your mind. And then you find out the war had been over for 2 days. What did that do to you? How did you wrap your brain around that?
Well, when he said he'd meet us in Shanghai, I wrapped my brain around that, because that's a long, long walk. You're going from here to the tip of Idaho and Canada. Walking.
When that sunk in, that the war was over, and here you've been a part of helping with millions of other Americans and their allies of bringing this to an end. Was there a sense of pride, of accomplishment, of celebration? How would you describe what it felt like to know that this was all over and you'd get to go home?
I think in some ways celebration. I think all of us had to know that what we were doing was worthwhile. I think that we were following orders as enlisted men, and yet some of us took a lot of responsibility because there weren't always officers around. And so I think it was a relief to know that, and some a little bit relief, but there were a lot of Japanese in between Amoy and Shanghai that didn't know the war was over. That came about 2, 3, 4 days later, you know, as they got information. It wasn't instant information like it is now. I think having to be very careful winding our way through country we'd never been in before. The Chinese that I was with, they'd never been in that part of the country before, and they didn't speak any Japanese, and I spoke enough to be just dangerous, you know, and so it was a relief that it was over, but we still had to be on guard because, well, when you steal a vehicle, well, somebody's going to be after you also, and so you, that was how we made do, was take anything you take in order to get the job done.
So at that point, did you have it in your mind that you were going to get to come back to America pretty soon? I know that's not exactly what happened, but what were you looking forward to at that point?
The next day, getting to Shanghai, and that was the dissolution of our outfit. That's the way we dissolved. And so I stayed on in China after that. In fact, I was in China until I got out of the Navy. So I was in China for another year, year and a half after that. So
everyone thinks about the war and they put a start date and an end date on it. But in reality, there was a lot more going on in the world. And a lot of people, a lot of the top brass in America were looking forward to a coming battle with the forces of communism. And one of those battles started to play out right there in China, the battle for China between General Chiang Kai-shek and, of course, the communists and Mao Zedong. Now, you were involved in some secret clash at that point between those forces. Do I have that straight?
Well, in a way, we had to give all the information that we had to the headquarters, of course, and then we had to be ready to go up there. By the way, the last naval battle of World War II happened on the Yangtze River, and that was kind of interesting. A couple of our guys had come down from Camp 10. We had 14 camps of Sako people all around different places in China, and they were coming down on a Chinese junk about the last day or maybe just past the last day of the war, and they came up on a Japanese gunboat. And what these guys had that, of course, that the Japanese didn't know, they had some bazookas, and they had 5 rounds and a bazooka launcher. And so the Japanese shot at the ship. Chinese junk is a sailing vessel. And these guys got out their deal and blew the boat all to pieces, and they rescued 2 men that they captured. And the rest of the men went down with the Yangtze River. But that is logged on as the last naval battle of the war. And it was a Chinese junk with Americans on it, some Americans on it, and a Japanese boat that probably didn't know there were any Americans left in the world. So that was kind of interesting. But after the war got over, I just hoped that somehow I was ready to go home. I signed up for World War II, and when World War II got over, I thought that'd be a good thing to go back. But I stayed in an outfit, and we had to encounter 2 or 3 times the Chinese communists. They were all bunched up, about 30,000-35,000 of them, up in northeastern China. And at that time, we could have taken care of all of them with aircraft and land forces, and it didn't happen. And I think we lost 116 troops of different, or mostly Marines, in the battle that we had early on with Mao Zedong.
And this is something people have, for the most part, never heard about, because the last thing the American government wanted out in the news at that point, after this giant war had been fought and they had won, was that they were still fighting. Were you under instructions not to repeat anything, not to tell the story of what happened at all?
I don't remember that, but I know the OSS indicated to us that we couldn't fight any of them. And by that time, we didn't want to fight anyway. We'd come really clean through the war. Some of our outfit that were over on the East Coast, we rescued 76 or 77 downed airmen who had been flying over to Japan. Their aircraft was crippled some way, and they could make it back to China and parachute out. And our outfit pulled in, it was 76 or 77 of those flyboys, and we were glad to do that. But we were ready to come home. The war was over, and then we got messed up with the communists. And so what I did after that was I was transferred to a group called the Subic China Ship Group. And we would fly down to Subic Bay and then go on down to Manila and get a decommissioned American ship or boat and put the armament into working order. And then we'd sail it up to China, to Shanghai, and teach the Chinese how to use it. We'd sail up then to Tsintsin or Chifu and get in a little firefight with the communist forces and then go like everything, cluck, 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 down to Shanghai again, and then we'd fly down and get another ship to come in. By this time, most of the young officers were already go home, so I was a second-class petty officer, which is low-down E5, I think they call them, and I had my own crew. I had 23 men in my crew, and the only other second-class was a pharmacist mate, and we stayed together for about, I don't know, 9 or 10 months, and we took three ships up from the Philippine Islands up to China, and finally, my birthday was coming up, and so the old man said, well, do you want to go home? And I said, yeah, I'd like to go home. And I got on a ship that took 42 days to come back from China to the U.S. of A. I might as well swam. It was terrible. I wanted to go home by then.
What did it feel like to get home?
I think we came back, most of us, with a sense of pride that we'd done the best job we could do, whether that was enough or not. I came back knowing also that we had lost very few people out of our outfit. I came back hoping and praying that I could see my mom and dad, my sisters again, and a younger brother that I really didn't know very well. He's 12 years younger than I am. It was good to get back and see what the U.S. of A. was like. I came back into Long Beach and got out of a place just south of San Francisco, and they talked me into being a reservist. And so when Korea came along, well, because of my Chinese training, when China got in with North Korea, well, they pulled me back in. But this officer that met me when I was on my way to Korea, Lieutenant Commander, and he asked me my name and rank and what I did. And then he asked me if I played softball. And I said, yes, sir. He said, what do you do? I said, I pitch. He said, are you any good? You know, that's a lousy question to ask. And I said, well, I've won quite a few games. And he said, follow me. And I said, I have orders to go to Korea, sir. And he tapped his shoulder pieces and he said, I said, follow me. I said, yes, sir. So I followed him, got in his Jeep, went out to an attack tug. And we had 37 men, usually 37 men on board. 23 played AAA fast pitch softball that he'd collected. He had a friend in the Bureau of Personnel in Washington, D.C. And so anybody that said softball, he met them. And at one time, we had, I think, 111 wins and 14 losses in the time I was in Hawaii. And I much rather be in Hawaii, even though it was on temporary duty, so I couldn't have my wife with me. And so my number two son was born, and he was 8 months old before I ever saw him.
But am I hearing right that just like softball had changed your direction early in the war, that when it comes to Korea, softball saved you from going over there?
It really did.
It maybe saved your life.
It may have. And I played a lot of softball after I got home. And my wife said that she finally came to the conclusion if softball had saved my life a couple of times, well, maybe I could go ahead and play as long as it was not on Sunday. And the old man over in Hawaii, he wanted us to play on Sunday morning. And there were four of us who were Christians on the team, the catcher and myself as a pitcher. We had one other pitcher. And so we told him we wouldn't play. And he said, well, if I command you to play, will you? And we said, no. You want to put us in the brig? Fine. But your argument probably wouldn't be very good that you wanted us to play softball instead of going to church. And so we got to go to church and then play softball in the afternoon if we had to.
Well, and since you mentioned church, I know we're running short on time here, but you are a retired pastor, more than 45 years in the ministry. How did that come about? I mean, you've been been through all of this in the military. How did you end up in the ministry?
Well, my dad had established a little school in Boise called Boise Bible College. And so I was home with nothing to do and no family except my mom and dad. And so I had the GI Bill, so I thought, well, I'll take a year or so of college and stay with the folks and see how things go. But then I got really interested in college and decided that maybe that would be a good thing. Maybe 7 months after I started college, a little church asked if a couple of us would come out and preach for them. And they were very kind and very wonderful because they never criticized us any and gave us a good meal and gas money. And so that kind of started the ministry way back then. And I was a freshman in college and trying to preach, and I know it was just really terrible. But they were sweet, sweet people, and they helped us. And then I got married, and we started having kids, and I'd go to some college and get out of college, go to college and get out. And now anytime I go to an alumni meeting, well, they ask, who is it here that took the longest time to graduate from Boise Bible College? And I slipped my hand up, and it took 19 years.
That's impressive. Certainly persistence. 17 years, okay. Well, persistence is a good character trait. When you look back on everything that you experienced, some pretty unique experiences, what would you say you're most thankful for?
Knowing God as my Lord, Savior, and His Son, Jesus. Because you can't lose, dead or alive, as a Christian. And there's many wonderful Christians in the armed forces. Some of us get scared into it, and some of us have been born into it and live it while we're in there. So I think knowing that God is my ruler and His Son is my Savior is what kept me and what will always keep me for the rest of my life.
The work Don Hardenbrook has done as a civilian for the last 70-plus years has been decidedly different from what he was asked to do in China. I do highly encourage you to check out that SACO website, SACO Navy, that's SACONavy.net. You can spend all day there learning some of this fascinating history. Of course, I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we've been allotted today, but I hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.